I believe we left off right around here talking about this you who am I example in which this thing, some made up function here, you calls who, which we're, yeah, we step through it like this. So, you know, so you calls who, and the stack frame is growing on our right. So now who is at the quote unquote top of the stack, and then calls am I. So, you know, who is still sort of stuck in the middle of whatever it was doing. It's data, local variables are still stored up in its stack frame, but now am I is executing, which happens to be a recursive function. So am I getting called again gets its own stack frame for each instance of this recursive function. So if we have a depth of three here, each of these invocations of am I has its own stack frame. And so that makes sense where each one can compute whatever value it's going to return. And then when this whole thing reaches the base case and unwinds, that amount will get, the result will get returned to the previous one, which will do whatever computation, you know, adding or whatever computation it's doing. And as these functions return, it sort of unwinds like this. You can even have another call to something else, another return, and eventually this thing who returns. And we're back to U is has its memory, stack memory, just where it left off before all that other stuff happens. So this is the illustration of stack frame, of many stack frames in memory while functions are getting called. So this is where we left off, right? So we had a diagram like this, which is basically saying, so we have the caller frame, the previous function that's about to make a function call. So it has its data and whatnot in its stack frame up in here. And then when it comes time to make a call instruction, well, it's going to set up for that call instruction by getting its arguments or parameters ready for that thing that's about to get called. Now, in the past, that would have all been pushed into stack memory, but x86-64 uses registers to be faster. So what you'll see is before the call, some moves into registers like RDI and RSI, et cetera, according to the calling convention. But if there were more than six, there are only six registers devoted to this job. So if there happened to be more than six, then stack memory would be used for arguments seven and up. An unusual case, but there's no actual constraint on how many function arguments there could be. But what we have here, most importantly, is this return address. And so that's the last thing, right when that call instruction executes, two things happen, a push and a jump. So the push is this return address, where to return to after the function call is finished. So that gets pushed into memory here. Right at the very, you know, the very end of the stack frame, at the very edge before the next stack frame gets created. So we're really going to be focusing on this return address. This frame pointer, RBP, is sort of an anachronism. Optimizing compilers won't use that, so that's why it says it's optional. So it's kind of grayed out. But then the new stack frame below at lower memory addresses will have local variables for the new called function, and this says argument build if it were to call functions, and then save registers. We'll talk about that briefly, but really local variables is what we're paying most attention to here, and the return address. So let's keep an eye on those two things. Incidentally, these are the two things you're gonna be paying most attention to in Attack Lab. So is there any questions on this so far? This is, I think this is what we got through last class on Monday. So we have a few more examples in here. We're not going to spend a ton of time in them because we want to get to the more interesting stuff. But this is just some more real simple C functions and corresponding assembly code. This is one of our textbook examples, so it uses the AT&T syntax that we don't love with the queues after the assembly instructions. But of course, you know how to call OBJ dump and whatnot to get this in the format you're used to. In any case, this is really just demonstrating that, again, the calling convention has RAX for return values and RDI and RSI for parameters 1 and 2. In this, I want to look a little bit more at this call increment function. So there's just some things at the beginning and end that we want you to pay attention to, because you're going to be doing this in Attack Lab. And you may have even noticed when doing Bomb Lab that, like, wow, all these functions, you know, phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, et cetera, they all start with, like, subtract on RSP and end with an add on RSP. And we may have told you at the time, well, there's all these instructions. You don't have to pay attention to every single one. You know, you want to focus on the, you know, conditional jumps and what determines how, you know, how a program ends up calling a explode bomb or not. Okay, so that's what you did in Bomb Lab. I think you're all good at that, following control flow through, like, conditions and loops and stuff like that. That's great. Okay, so now we need to pay more attention to this stack pointer stuff. So coming back around to this. So when this thing call incur, or when any function gets called, again, call those two things, push and jump, pushing the return address. So RSP points to this return address. So right when the function's called, before anything has happened, you know, before any, you know, before the subtract or move or any of this, this is our stack with RSP pointing right at the return address. Now, call incur, or most functions, are gonna need some amount of space on the stack for local variables. And that's true of this one. So once it once this function starts, the first thing it's going to do is subtract the stack pointer to basically make space to work with. And this says a subtract of 16. So in Intel assembly, when you do this in GDB or OBJ dump, you're going to see this in hexadecimal. So you know 16 in hexadecimal, right? That would be rendered 10. In any case, this is the decimal value 16, a subtract an RSP. So why 16?
Is it because you want to have space for 4 bytes, so you multiply your bytes, but you multiply the amount of space you want that by 4 because of how bytes are, because they each have 4 bits?
I think you're maybe overthinking this a bit. I didn't totally follow, but let's just look at the C function, you know, 3 lines on top. And from that, I think we can answer the question just from looking there. Anyway, I appreciate you kind of thinking out loud, but let's just, if we just look at this C code up here, I think we can kind of determine what this means. So we're really concerned with local variables. So there are two, V1 and V2. So what do we know about these? Okay, good. I have the group chat open today. Love to hear your voices too, but okay, so in group chat, Jondral says long. Yeah, so V1 and V2 are both longs, exactly. So, and we can look up, if we don't, if we haven't memorized it, you know, when we went through data lab, we talked about different data types. Character is 1 byte, and int is 4 bytes. Well, long, if we we can look that up, but a long is 8 bytes, you know, also known as a long int is going to be 8 bytes. So that's why we, you know, it uses the RSP register, the RDI register. So if an int is 4 bytes, a long is 8 bytes. So V1 is 8 bytes, V2 is 8 bytes. Therefore, this function requires 16 bytes of local storage. So, therefore, there's a subtract of 16 at the beginning of this function. If this function used tons of data, I don't know, maybe like an array of 100 longs, well, there would need to be, 800 bytes on stack, which is reasonable. That can be done. 800 is not that big a number on our computers. So, yeah, we have 2 longs, 16 bytes. So, this is the compiler has decided when compiling this, okay, we're going to do subtract of 16 on the stack pointer. And now this thing, V1 gets a value of 15,213, just some made up number here. But that gets stored with a move instruction. Well, where? Okay, so in C, we call it V1, but in assembly, there aren't any nice, convenient register names here, but what there is just some offset from RSP. So RSP moved down by 16 bytes from, you know, from here at the return address down here, and then V1 happens to be the first chunk of this, which we'll call RSP plus 8, because RSP has moved down here. So the compiler is going to make assembly instructions that are some distance from RSP and put values in memory there. So the C program will call it V1, but assembly will really just call it an address relative to the stack pointer. Okay. Is that something, can we kind of see how we can look at this and see how the compiler turned into this? So, okay, there's a stuff in the middle. I'm not gonna spend a ton of time on it, but basically right before a call, we're gonna see values placed in RDI and RSI, or in this case, it's referenced ESI as the smaller half. You know, this is the constant 3000, and this address here is that thing 15213. So these are just setting up the arguments for the function call that's about to happen. There's only two, so we don't have to do any pushes to the stack, just these two registers. And with those two registers set up, the next thing will be the call. So of course, we talked about the call, those two things, a push and a jump. And then we have an add. Okay, so afterwards, this is really just the add of the result from the function with that value that was on the stack before. And that's really just computing what call incurs is going to return. But what we really want to pay attention to here is, oh, now there's an add of 16 on RSP. So why would there be an add on RSP here, the stack pointer?
It wouldn't be to like increase the stack, would it?
Well, I mean, it's taking RSP is an address, and it is, which is a number, and it's adding 16 to it. So in that sense, it's an increase. But that's not really what the goal is here. And let's sort of refer. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Are we putting the stack in its right place? Like we're putting the stack back?
Yeah, basically. I mean, an add is going, you know, up in this diagram. We have a somewhat better one, you know, this one. So, you know, when this function is returning, it's put its return value in RAX. So that's all it returns. So all the local variables in the stack can go away now. So we're taking RSP from here at the bottom of the stack frame that is finishing and moving it back to, well, where it was before. So again, you know, when these things return here, you know, when who returns, RSP needs to go back up to point at you again. So that's an add. You see how RSP has sort of moved up in this diagram. So even though it's maybe seems a little weird to be like, wait, we're taking away stack space by adding, but because of the direction this is oriented in, it isn't actually an add instruction, even though really it's making this green space go away here. So seems a little funny, but can you all work with that? So, and the other way to look at it is, and I think that's what I also heard there, was that we're putting RSP back where it was before this add, before the subtract up here on the top. So if you start by subtracting 16 and finish by adding 16, RSP should be right back where it started, right? And of course, what was it pointing at the start? There's a pretty crucial value there. And that is the return address. So, and of course, there's about to be a return instruction here. So that return instruction does two things. Which two things? Y'all know? So call did two things, a push and a jump. Return does two things. Well, it's also a jump, right? Because it's going to go back to some other location. But jump where? Well, it's got to get that value from somewhere. And that is a pop operation in that it's whatever RSP is pointing to. So this return instruction depends on RSP pointing at a return address, which it did before this subtract happened. So the add has put RSP right back where it needs to be pointing, which is the return address for this return instruction to jump to. So this is all how the compiler sets up this assembly to actually work right with calls and returns. Questions?
Hello?
Yes, hello.
What if you did the return before you, like, you see how you subtracted 16 at the very beginning? What if you didn't add everything back and then did the return?
If there's no add at the bottom, what would happen? Well, so yeah, that's a good question, because the return instruction isn't gonna, I mean, the return instruction does, you know, one thing exactly one way, and it doesn't get to like stop and think, oh, what should I do? The return instruction is going to take whatever value RSP is pointing at and jump to it. So if there's no add instruction here, well, RSP, let me back it up. So RSP is going to be pointing at what? And, you know, V1 and V2 are the values on the stack that RSP points to. And it turns out it's being used because it just stays in registers the whole time, which is really only works because it's a very short function. But in any case, this is either, you know, this is either zeros or some number for V2, you know, the same way that 15,213 is here. But either way, if RSP was pointing at 15213, then it would attempt to jump to that location, and that would be, you know, that's not going to be a valid memory location for more instructions. It's probably almost certainly going to be a segmentation fault, because that's just going to be a bad address. But if it was an address that actually had instructions at it, it would start executing, which could be, you know, wrong stuff or whatever. So the compiler wouldn't like forget to do this add instruction, because without that, the program either crashes or just totally malfunctions. But okay. But it's an interesting question, because we are gonna address this. Well, what if it jumped somewhere else and it wasn't totally, you know, an immediate crash or something like that? So that does sort of foreshadow something. So I like the question.
All right, thank you.
Since y'all are asking, let's get to like, well, what happens if RSP isn't where it's supposed to be, or what if the return address isn't quite right? Just to wrap this up though a little bit, there is a little bit more about register saving, which was mentioned briefly in, let's see, right around here. So it says save registers and local variables. So we talked about local variables. Great. Save registers. Well, briefly, you know, registers don't change when there's a call. I mean, the stack pointer does and the instruction pointer does, but all the other registers will, you know, retain their values. You've seen this before because you've stepped, you know, into a function in GDB, and all those registers, you see it printed out on top, they haven't changed. So, you know, the caller function, you probably expects, you know, certain registers to have values in them based on what happened early in the function, like it did a move into RDX. Well, what happened if the thing that it called changed that register? How can the calling function, you know if its data is still there or something's been overwritten? Well, need some coordination. The functions need to be able to like trust that their values are still working. So there's a convention for it that registers are either saved by the caller before making a call to make sure allow the called function to change it, or callee saved, which is the thing being called does the save. And but actually both of these conventions are used. And there's just a different registers follow different conventions. We're not going to ask you to memorize all of this, but you can look it up anytime you need to check. We know RAX contains a return value. We know these six registers are for arguments, but we have other registers. These are R10 and R11 are defined as caller saved. So the the function doing the call, the outer function needs to like save those values before making the call. And then these registers are are called callee saved. So the function being called needs to make sure that they get put back when finished. And then base pointer and stack pointer are their own special thing that we've been talking about. So the only quick example here is in this other version, again, we have a subtract on the stack pointer and an add on the stack pointer at the beginning and end, but there's also a push and a pop. And this is really just, this is call incur2 saying, okay, RBX needs to be preserved so that when whoever called this function continues, RBX is still valid. So at the very beginning of this function, we have a push of RBX to somewhere in memory. And at the end, there's a pop of RBX before the arithmetic on the stack pointer here. So basically what this says is whatever was in RBX at the top will be in RBX at the bottom, even though it changes somewhere in the middle. So that is just saving a register. And sometimes you'll see this depending on which register and how complicated the function is. So that's just another thing that we see at the very beginning of a function and the very end, doing something and then undoing it. And that allows RBX to get changed in the middle here. And so there will be a little bit of space on the stack for that saved RBX. It's in between the local variables and the return address. So that's just one other thing that can happen in stack memory. I don't think it's going to come up a lot in Attack Lab, but you will probably see these pushes and pops, and you don't need to like kind of pull your hair out over them. We can always just kind of look up the rules on saved registers. Questions? So we had the recursive example before. I'm just gonna. This is another. Interesting one. We won't spend a ton of time with it though. But basically just going through and showing this function being compiled in assembly, and then when it, when the C function runs, let's just sort of we can see the various parts of the C code in assembly here. So this base case is, well, if X is equal to zero and we have a test instruction and a conditional jump, return, and of course EAX, if it's going to return zero, that needs to be in the EAX or RAX register. So that's the base case, fine. There's a push in RBX, and if you see there's actually a pop of RBX later on, well, that's saving a register that gets changed. Okay, we know about that. Now we have a move, an and, and a shift. Well, this is all kind of setting up this else case. There's a shift on X, but there's also an operation on X, so we need to save it before it gets shifted. And that's actually the parameter to pop count is what gets shifted. So RDI at the time of the recursive call needs to contain the shifted value. We have a call, great, and then its result ends up in RAX, which then gets added. Now, of course, it's a call of the same thing, p count r, but that's going to get a new stack frame and a new place to store, a new way to store x, and this whole thing will eventually unwind when it reaches the base case. So there can be many stack frames that for the same function that calls itself recursively. The way it's designed, we don't need any special rules for recursive functions. This means it's just that the stack works right for recursion and normal functions, even works for mutual recursion. This last in first out system works for recursion, and registers and return addresses are saved on the stack, and this all works great. Well, unless it doesn't. So we're going to talk about when it doesn't. But all of this is just to give you the ground rules on how calls and stack memory work, so that when we break them, we know what we're doing. Also, breaking them is kind of, well, fun to some people and a great way to actually really learn this stuff. So, ready to break some stuff? This is the summary with the diagram we've showed already. So we'll be working with stack stuff a lot going forward. Are you ready? So let's talk overflow stuff. So we have a new slide set for today. Looks like this. We have some announcements already. And you've already saw these last week, but I'll mention them again. TacLab is out. Our TAs did a demonstration of this last class. You can go watch the video on the schedule if you missed it. You'll be using GDB. You'll have your own unique program. But there's no explosions, so don't panic. You already know how to do breakpoints, so you don't need explosions to teach you that. But that's due out 2 weeks from Monday. But there is also, in addition to solving phases, you do need to hand in an explanation to Autolab, just a text file of your solution. And that'll have comments explaining what all this stuff is, because your solution is going to be just a bunch of bytes, and we need to explain it. And then there'll be a scoreboard, and you'll be able to see what's happening. So as you get close to finishing, stay in touch with us. We'll make sure your comments are up to our expectations. And that is, as usual, these comments are not just to be annoying, but we want to, convince us that you know what's going on. So we're here to talk about, well, memory layouts, what we've been talking about. Again, we ended with this, so this is still in here. We'll refer back to this. But to sort of zoom out a bit in the full memory region, well, we have stack memory up at this kind of top area, and we're going to see stack addresses tend to have these addresses that begin with 7 and are kind of long. And then program code, which is really called text in this anachronistic name for this, but program instructions are way down here, starting around 400000. Again, you'll see this in OBJ dump and GDB, which you did in Bomb Lab also. So these are all memory addresses that are kind of far from each other, and we've been sort of zoomed in just on the stack area. Heap memory, we're not really going into here, but it's separate from stack memory. Okay, great. That's stuff that persists even independent of function calls. And then there's sort of read-only data in a certain region. Of course, these are all virtual memory addresses. So virtual memory makes it possible for lots of processes to all use the same structure. They can all start at the same 400 address, and they can all use similar stack addresses and not overwrite each other's stuff. So these are virtual addresses, and every process will have a layout of its own pretty much like this. And we can actually see in a C program, we're not caring too much about about heap memory, but that's where these malloc calls put stuff. But we can actually see, using GDB, we can look at addresses of various things and see where they end up. We're really just concerned with local variables going into stack memory. And then some read-only stuff goes down in this data area. And then our functions have these 400 addresses. So we're going to focus on the yellow area and the purple area here. So I want to start with an example of some code like this. And we actually have this on Systems Lab in a C file with this path given here. So I'm actually going to run this program, and hope you can look at the source code also. But take a look real quick and see. We have this thing, a struct. Well, it's really just, it's if arrays are two of the same data type, there's an array of two ints, but a struct is really heterogeneous, you would say, so different types of data altogether. So there is two ints here. Of course, we remember ints are 4 bytes, and doubles are double precision floating point. That's 8 bytes, like a long. So there's 16 bytes of stuff here in the struct that gets given the name S. And these members are accessed with the dot notation. So member D of struct S is given this value, 3.14, a floating point value. And then we write an integer into this array A, but where? Well, index I. So it all depends on what I is, and that's going to change. So take a look and think that over. And I'm going to run this real quick. And of course, you can run this also because you have an account on Systems Lab, right? So if I run this, y'all can see this, right? Terminal look okay?
Yes.
Okay, So you can run this thing struct mem. You can also look at the source code. Okay, well, we have to give this a parameter. What this parameter is going to be is the value for I. So if I is 0, we write to A of 0, which is normal, right? And we write some number, and then that thing D stays 3.14. Well, it says 3.1401. Well, it turns out 3.04 can't be completely in base 2, doesn't have a finite representation, so it's really close to 3.14. Floating point is kind of imperfect. If I is equal to 1, well, we still, call phone of 1, and that doesn't do anything weird. So 0 and 1, well, if A has an array of size 2, I don't know if you can still have those slides open on your end to see. We can also just look at the source code real quick. So if, again, we're going to see this thing A has size 2, so array index 0 and array index 1 would be like, you know, normal uses of A. But since we know that these local variables are in stack memory, and A and D are going to be right next to each other, so when we call this thing fun with an I larger than 1, with 0 and 1 we did so far, that's all kind of normal. You can actually see down here, we call this A to I thing. I think you all saw in Shell Lab a little bit to convert it to an int. So what happens here when I call it with 2, well, this is kind of weird because now my floating point value in D, well, it's changed a little bit, but it's basically the same. It's gone from just slightly over 3.14 to slightly below. Kind of weird. What if we write to A of 3? Well, now that floating point number has like changed a lot instead of changed a little. What if I just keep going to higher array indices? Now, if this was a Java program, we would have like, what would happen here? Like, exception array index, something like that, right? C lets us use whatever array index we want. So when I call this with 4, well, now what's going to happen? Segmentation fault. Okay, so the program has crashed. So that is just sort of a, there's some weird stuff going on that might just seem like, oh, this program's buggy. I don't know what's up with that. But we do have an explanation that for that because we know how stack memory works. So this is basically a summary of how I just ran it. We saw the number, everything was fine on 0 and 1, a slight change to D on when called with 2, a big change to D when called with 3. Now, this slide was made on a different system, so we actually segmentation fault at fun 4, that particular detail of when it crashes is more system specific. So that's basically what happened, right? Except for the fun of 4. That's a little different. But basically the same thing. Everything was fine the first two times. Minor change, big change, crash. So if we look at how stack memory is laid out, we actually see this thing, array of 2 ints, A of 0 and A of 1. Well, they're both stored in somewhere in memory on the stack, A of 0 and A of 1. But A of 2, well, it's outside the array A, but it's really some amount, A starts here and some distance beyond A. A of 2 would be, well, there's 8 bytes in this double D, and A of 2 would be writing to one half of that double D, and A of 3 would be writing to the other half. And if we take a look at how floats work, which you can kind of look up, I don't think we did a lot with this semester, but a double precision float is 8 bytes long, so one half, the low half of it, is really just little fraction bits, the things way to the right of the decimal point. And then the upper part has like the exponent and the big fraction bits. So when writing to the upper half, big things can change. In this case, we actually chose this value specifically. Like if it had been a bigger value, we might have even gotten a negative number. But this is all because these numbers live in stack memory, and a bug in a program can cause a value to get overwritten. So this is a bug in a program dealing with stack memory. What do you think? it's actually kind of boring, right? Because like, okay, we saw like a minor numerical difference, or maybe even a big numerical difference, or maybe even a segmentation fault. None of those things are very interesting. So let me look at one further example, also on Systems Lab. So I have a program called, it's in the same directory that you all have access to, pwcheck. So this is a program, asks you for a password. I wonder what it is. I don't know. ABC. That was wrong. Okay. So this, of course, is a simple program that is not actually doing anything important. But, of course, you do know that there are programs that do important things based on whether you have a valid password or not. So we're going to, let's, you know, pretend like that's what's happening here. This program is checking for a password. And if it's right, you get stuff. And if it's wrong, you don't. You're all familiar with this kind of scenario. So this is a C source code. And if we come down, it starts like this. I wrote this a few years ago. So if we go down, let's start by looking at main here. So this is everything we saw. It's a short program. Prints this thing, reads a password, and then it said root privilege is not given, right? So let's talk about result. What do we know about result?
It's calling a method.
Well, okay. Down below there's a function call. I'm actually just talking about like the on this first line of main int result. I'm being like super picky here. Okay, so Max says it's an int. Okay, tell me more about ints. What do you know about an int? How big is it? I'll remember this. Oh, well, okay. Now he's picking two things. Throw out a whole bunch of numbers. Surely one of them will be right. Ints are 4 bytes. Ints are 4 bytes. Y'all remember this. Okay, so we now have 4 bytes in stack memory. Main is a function like any other, and it has local space on the stack. So there are 4 bytes in stack memory called result. And then this thing check password gets called, and whatever it returns goes in the REX register and goes in the same result. And then this printf statement is kind of interesting because prints this, and then we have this thing here. This is a string gets substituted in. Well, what gets substituted in for this string? What do we make of this? This is a type of conditional statement. It's shorter than an if statement, sometimes even called ternary operator. So if this thing result is, well, you would say true, but really like non-zero. If result is non-zero, given is substituted here. And if result is zero, not given is substituted here. And so that basically means this thing check password either returns 1 or 0. We can look at the source to that in a second. Of course, then it actually doesn't do anything besides sleep and finish, because this is like an example. But like, imagine that it did something like super important here, depending on what result is. But anyway, you kind of get the premise here, right? It's going to check a password. So what should we type? Well, we have the source code. We don't even have to run GDB. So let's see like what is happening here. So check password has local variables, a thing called buffer. Characters are 1 byte each. There are 15 bytes here. And there's a thing called correct pass in stack memory. 4 bytes, also a 0. Starts initialized as 0. Prints enter the password. We saw that before. Calls this function to read in what I type into this thing buffer, which is in stack memory. We have the string compare function, which, interestingly enough, returns 0 when the strings, when buffer matches this password. So this must be the password, because when str compare returns 0, we get correct password, and this incorrect pass gets set to 1, which is great. We want that. If we don't type love 2467, it's wrong. So now we know the password, right? And we know if it's the correct password, we get a 1 for correct pass. So now we know what to run. Let's try. You ready? Y'all can run this too, by the way, if you want. What was the password? That was the password, right? Great password. So, correct password, root privilege is given to the user. All right, finish checking password. Cool. Okay, so now we've like gotten whatever we want. Okay, well, that was easy. We just had to read the source code for the password. But let's pretend like we couldn't do that or this was important. Well, if I had typed something else, I get wrong password, root privilege is not given. So there's basically two outcomes here. Right password, privilege is given. Wrong password, no privilege is given. So that's the end of it. Just type the right password and everything's fine. The program's working great. Well, there actually is another outcome here, which is kind of interesting. So if I were to give actually a long input of certain length, I actually saw that there was a 15 character buffer here. So, okay, now it says wrong password, root privilege is given to the user, segmentation fault, huh? I actually typed too much here. If I actually go a little bit shorter, we'll actually see. I can get wrong password, but also root privileges given, finish checking password. So this is kind of crazy, right? Because it's supposed to only go one way or the other way, but it's like both things have happened. And then if I type way too much, I actually get a segmentation fault. So if we look at this, we can actually see that it's deciding whether or not to print root privileges given based on what this incorrect pass is. If it's non-zero, print this thing and return one, otherwise return zero. So it all comes down to what correct pass is, and it turns out that correct pass is stored in the stack right next to this thing buffer. So if I write past the end of buffer, I can actually modify correct pass. I mean, you saw me do this with that 3.14 getting modified, and it seemed like, okay, whatever, I like changed a number slightly. Well, if you can change a number slightly, if that number stores whether or not you get in the system or not, that isn't so trivial anymore. So what do you think? Maybe a little less boring now. Of course, I've intentionally written this program to do it this way, but it is a useful example, I think. So this is what we're really getting to here. Called buffer overflow. So that 15 character thing, I wrote past it, and it changed some data. First example was sort of some boring data, and I tried to make a slightly less boring example in the second one. You can see the source code to both of these and see how they might look, they're short and generally pretty reasonable. But let's talk about what this is. So this actually has big implications, not just a tiny little detail. So why is that? Well, for some time now, over decades, there have been just countless numbers of security problems in software, including important software, due to flaws in programs dealing with buffer overflows. So our text calls this the number one technical cause of security vulnerabilities. So they're being very specific about technical. There's actually a much bigger problem of non-technical social security vulnerabilities. So I don't know if you've heard this term, social engineering, but this is basically the idea that if you call someone on the phone and tell them, trust me, give me your password, it'll be fine. Even if only a small fraction of people fall for it, you can still get a lot of passwords that way. So that's an even bigger problem, but not a technical issue for a systems class. Common form of this is a string input, which is what I gave for my password there. Length not checked onto a character array of certain bounds, 15 characters max to that buffer in that particular program. I chose something pretty small to make this example work easily. So sometimes this is called stack smashing because I actually took one piece of stack memory and went beyond it and overwrote something that wasn't supposed to be overwritten and changed some stuff. So that is the definition of buffer overflow. You've seen two little examples, and we have some slides and examples in the text that'll tell you how to do this, because this is what you have to do to solve Attack Lab. So there is C target and R target are two programs that we've given you that have buffer overflow vulnerabilities in them, you know, simply overflowing the buffer, meaning like putting in too much stuff, that's easy. You can just mash on the keyboard until you do that. But making a program cause a segmentation fault, that's not that interesting. David even showed you doing that. David and Sarod showed you in Monday's class. So it says, ouch, I guess, segmentation fault, but that doesn't actually accomplish anything. However, if you do this correctly, you can avoid the segmentation fault and actually just make the program do whatever you want. So to start, we can look at this function get s, which is what read my password in that program. This is a well-known insufficient buggy function that we don't use anymore, but we kind of used in that one example to show that all it does is read the buffer without checking how many to read. So the manual page for this actually says quite clearly under description, never use this function. So that is, it's known to have a buffer overflow problem. Now, of course, that first example I showed you didn't use get s at all. It actually just read an integer. So you can totally have buffer overflows without using get s. You know, string inputs is one common way. But in that case, I just had a, you know, a bug with integers in the first case. So it's not just get s, but this is like the easiest way to see it. So we can look at a program like this that takes, you know, this character buffer 4 is way too small, so reading more than 4 things, well, you can run this, and sometimes it'll be fine, but some input beyond a certain length will cause segmentation fault. Again, I've sort of said making the program crash is not that exciting, but we can figure out exactly when it crashes or when it matters and when it doesn't. And exactly when it becomes a problem, that's by disassembling. So that's what, again, you'll be doing in Attack Lab using OBJDump and or GDB. Well, if we look at this, it all comes back to that subtract on the stack pointer that we were just talking about. So if there's a subtract, and of course now it's in hexadecimal, but if there's a subtract on the stack pointer, this is actually the number 24 in decimal. So subtract of 24 and an add of 24 afterwards. That's how much stack space is used during this thing echo. Now, like, why would it be 24? Like, that code said buff was only 4. Well, sometimes the compiler adds extra space for alignment reasons that are not terribly exciting, but basically, you just need to look and see, you need to look at the disassembly to see how large the stack frame is for each for a function. If you're trying to do an overflow on this echo function, calls get s, well, this thing here tells you that there's 24 bytes of stack memory. And so we can actually diagram this in something like this. So this is where we'll leave it for today. You'll read some more of this in chapter 3. I believe it's section 310 on our schedule. So this will tell you more about how to see when bytes get written to this thing buff. So when a few bytes get written, it's no big deal. And even when it goes overflows a little bit, it's fine. But there's a certain point where we reach this return address. And that's when it matters. That's when it gets interesting. So we'll talk about that more. But for now, you should be able to read the Attack Lab write-up and the textbook and get started. The phase one of Attack Lab is pretty easy. You just have to count out how many bytes to put into buffer and then override a return address. It gets a lot more complicated after that, so please start on the easy ones. We'll be ready to talk to you about them. Also, don't forget, we do not have class on Friday, so we will next see you on Monday. So read that Attack Lab write-up. There's a lot in there. And get your targets downloaded and start looking at it, start messing with it, and you'll have questions for us next time we see you, I hope. And once you figure out how to do this and get started, it can actually go pretty quick, but you got to start. So please do start, and we will see you soon. Hope you have a nice long weekend, and happy hacking on your buffer overflows. What are your questions?
Will the help desk be open on Friday still, or
I do not think so. I mean, that's not my call, but I believe they, you know, they'll have a holiday like the rest of us. So, you know, I think they deserve a long weekend too.
Okay, I was just wondering.
But also, you should ask Jonathan what his schedule is. That's I'm just giving you my opinion.
Okay, thank you. Also, was it like, did tomorrow also have a day off, or?
I believe that is what the I believe that's what came from the president's office. But again, I know as much as you do as far as the plans for tomorrow. What are your other classes saying?
I mean, like, I'm just wondering, so I'm like, just so I know how I should be working on another assignment. That's all.
Okay. Well, ask the help desk or, I mean, it's not my call. So, I hope you can find an answer.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Well, that does it for today. Thanks, everyone. Hope you have fun with buffer overflows. Check out those examples on Systems Lab and of course, Attack Lab.